You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. God Complex. Silicon Valley was once driven by a godless chase for growth. Now the new religion is religion. By Zoe Bernard. Opening illustration of a pixelated Christ figure by Tamim Sankari. It's mid-October in San Francisco, and a crowd of 200 or so congregates, some seated in pews, others standing below cathedral windows at the back, bow their heads in prayer. Over cranberry apple cosmos and plates of Burmese food served by black-shirted waiters, a DJ plays a thumping soundtrack of remixed worship music. This is not a church service or even a Bible study. It is, instead, an entirely new kind of event in Silicon Valley. We are here to listen in on a conversation between Dr. Francis S. Collins, the former director of the National Institutes of Health and leader of the Human Genome Project, and Gary Tan, the president and CEO of Silicon Valley's influential startup incubator Y Combinator, which has hatched thousands of tech companies with a combined valuation of more than $600 billion. The event is called Code and Cosmos, and its underlying thesis is that the fields of science and technology, once considered diametrically opposed to religion and spirituality, might converge with the teachings of the Bible. In other words, business networking for the spiritually curious. What is the real basis of morality? Collins asked the crowd. Why am I here? What happens after I die? Collins, a thin, owlish man, gazes solemnly at the crowd, which already seems to have a sense of where this is going. Science, he says, can't really give you an answer. But there is another answer to these questions, and it has to do with one Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom Collins encountered as a 20-something medical student, grappling with the limits of atheism. Ever since, he said, I've never really hit a situation where what I know as a rigorous scientist and what I believe as a Christ-centered Christian are in conflict. That this conversation is taking place not at a church, but in Tan's home, which, incidentally, happens to be a converted church a stone's throw from Dolores Park, may seem, as Tan tells us from the stage, a little bit unusual. There was a time, Tan says, when such a gathering would be maybe even reviled in San Francisco. Many in the room, myself included, remember vividly the period to which Tan is referring. It was a time not so very long ago, mostly in the 2010s, when Silicon Valley cultivated a stance of pointed hostility not only toward conservatism, but to the Protestant doctrines that underpin much of American life. For many years, the running joke, popularized by the HBO show Silicon Valley, was that in the Bay Area, Christianity was borderline illegal. Of course, there have always been Christians in Silicon Valley. They just knew better than to advertise their faith. This is to say, the Christians were effectively in hiding. And one specific place they were hiding was, according to Tan, on a spreadsheet made up of Christians in tech, which was passed around for years among a dozen or so of the techno-faithful. One of them was Trey Stevens, co-founder of the defense tech company Anduril and a partner at Founders Fund, the venture capital firm co-founded by Peter Thiel. Stevens, like Tan, has lately been speaking publicly about his faith in the context of Silicon Valley. He has hosted a Bible study reflecting on the teachings of René Girard, a French philosopher popular in certain libertarian-leaning tech circles. Spoken at his church about the connection between Christianity and innovation, and written in what seems a slightly contorted interpretation of the gospel about how basic venture investing principles are an exemplar of divine forgiveness. Near trays of sticky rice laid out on white tablecloths stood a woman with substantially false eyelashes, who, when I asked if she worked in tech, eyed my press credential nervously. "I'm an investor," she said, "in tech." When I prodded her further on what sectors she invested in, she doubled down. "I told you," she barked, "I invest in tech. Tech." She opened up only slightly when, to make conversation, as we stood waiting to speak to Tan, I asked if she was a Christian. Yes, in fact, she was, and had been for many years. And while she did not feel, in response to my suggestion, that she was unable to speak openly about her faith, it was a topic she avoided bringing up in professional settings, until the past year or so, when she began to sense a change. In recent months, she felt so comfortable as to wear her cross in public, and here she gestured to her neck, around which dangled a sparkly cross charm the size of my pinky fingernail. Nowadays, Christianity is rarely met with direct hostility in Silicon Valley, but there is still the lingering sense, at least in intellectual circles, that practicing it is a faux pas, said Michelle Stevens, who is Trey Stevens' wife and the founder of the organization hosting the Code and Cosmos event, Acts 17 Collective. The organization is named after a passage in the Acts of the Apostles in which the Apostle Paul visits ancient Greece and preaches the gospel to intellectuals. "Like, how are you a smart person," she asks, "and a Christian?" Part of the problem is that for most of Silicon Valley's existence, its overarching monoculture privileged a certain type of smart person. It was the kind of smart person who campaigned for Barack Obama, marched for gay rights, and built a custom prayer stool to complement their priest fetish at the Folsom Street Fair. The subject of ethics was brought up frequently, but almost exclusively in the context of their non-monogamous relationships. Black Lives Matter signs sprouted from their yards, and if they strayed beyond the strictures of atheism into spirituality, it was of the Eastern variety. Being Muslim was actually kind of cool, because if you were against that, you were probably xenophobic. And Judaism was all right, too, because anti-Semitism was not yet in vogue. Maybe you know this person. Or maybe you are this person. Because it's a personality trait, while largely original to the Bay Area, has saturated mainstream consciousness so thoroughly as to become stripped of all of its original subversion. Go to almost any party of millennials in Los Angeles or New York, and you'll find the same iridescent sheathed package of psilocybin studded chocolate being passed around. What was once radical is now mundane. Burning Man is slouching toward Coachella, Richard Dawkins is a farce, and an uneasy realization is dawning that while we all thought we were locked arm in arm in humanity's cheerful march toward progress, we were only wandering into swift approaching regression. Even hard-nosed progressives had begun to sense that something rotten was simmering in the tepid cultural waters. Could it be that what society needed was a return to an ethical framework that had survived throughout millennia? Next photos, the apostles. Trey Stevens, co-founder of Anduril, Gary Tan, CEO of Y Combinator, and Peter Thiel, former CEO of PayPal, are three of the most visible technologists shepherding Silicon Valley into its religious reawakening. You don't need to do much guessing to see why smart Christians in Silicon Valley are growing more emboldened. After all, there are billionaires among their ranks. One of them is Peter Thiel, who has spoken about his evangelical leanings for more than a decade and who has lately shared his views on his faith with increasing frequency. "I believe in the resurrection of Christ," he said in a 2020 talk. "The only good role model for us is Christ." In watching talk after talk of Thiel speaking about his faith, I found myself genuinely puzzled, not because Thiel lacks conviction, but because his thoughts on the subject are so galaxy-brained that it seems like he's playing a game of 3D chess that the rest of us are only catching up to. When you don't have a transcendent religious belief, you end up just looking around at other people, and that is the problem with our atheist liberal world. It is just the madness of crowds. And it's not only Thiel. Last summer, in an interview with Jordan Peterson, Elon Musk described himself, cautiously, as a cultural Christian. "I do believe that the teachings of Jesus are good and wise," he said. "To have two of the world's richest technologists, worth a recently estimated $400 billion, Musk, and $14 billion, Thiel, speak admiringly about biblical teachings, challenges the view that Christianity is anti-capitalist or even anti-intellectual." Meanwhile, downstream of Thiel and Musk are people like Tan, who is busy shepherding the Valley's next cohort of entrepreneurs and who occasionally tweets scripture from his X account. It's a shift that follows the post-pandemic economic tightening that emboldened some CEOs to publicly embrace right-wing politics, write corporate statements in support of MEI, or merit, excellence, and intelligence as an antidote to DEI, and that earlier this year had Alex Karp, the CEO of the defense intelligence company Palantir, preaching at the AI Expo for national competitiveness in D.C. against the thin, corrosive, cancerous, pagan religion infecting our universities. Karp is, of course, referring to wokeism, which many on the right view as an excessive fixation with political correctness, especially as it relates to identity. In recent years, some influential Silicon Valley leaders have compared wokeism to a religion obsessed with original sin but lacking in redemptive salvation. The same evolution can be charted in the endorsements of formerly liberal venture capitalists. For instance, Chamath Palihapitiya, who after January 6th called President Donald Trump a complete piece of shit-effing scumbag, and who in June co-hosted a glitzy campaign fundraiser on the president's behalf. Within this new political climate, Silicon Valley's ambitions shifted, and along with them, a factory-fresh founder prototype emerged. It used to be that the 20-something whiz kid who coded a viral game and dropped out of Stanford was a venture capitalist darling. "VCs used to throw money at that guy," said a woman who manages communications at a top-tier venture firm. Now if someone comes in and says, "I love my parents so much, I grew up going to church, and then I joined the army, and that's what gives me my work ethic," VCs will be like, "Oh my God, that guy, let's fund that guy." The inception of this platonic ideal could be traced to the publication of venture capitalist Marc Andreessen's essay, It's Time to Build, in which he argued that over the last few decades, American innovation has fallen short. Where, he asked, are our supersonic aircraft, monorails, and high-speed trains? Western life, specifically American life, was permeated by a sense of smug complacency, a satisfaction with the status quo, Andreessen wrote. This was a problem, in his eyes, that ran deeper than politics. Our entire civilization had lost its way. It was time to return to the world of our forefathers and foremothers who built all the things we now take for granted, he continued. It's time for full-throated, unapologetic, uncompromised political support from the right, for aggressive investment in new products, in new industries, in new factories, in new science, in big leaps forward. Silicon Valley is now cultivating projects that embolden a vision slightly grander than that of subscription software, and these projects will be helmed not by some anemic ayahuasca-drinking softy, but by a new kind of entrepreneur, a serious person with a serious vision for the future. The Valley's most powerful venture capitalists are seeking entrepreneurs with the fire in the eyes, the ferocity of speech and action that is the physical manifestation of seriousness, writes Catherine Boyle, a partner at Andreessen Horowitz and co-founder of the firm's American Dynamism practice. No one wants the Palantir guy to be high on acid for 2 weeks at Burning Man, said that same venture capital communications exec. You want hard workers. People are like, I learned that at West Point. We have Israelis who served in the IDF and are religious and conservative and super libertarian, and we're like, yeah, that seems focused. We'll take that. That venture capitalists are seeking a new sort of entrepreneur is an expectation felt palpably among the many aspiring founders at the Code and Cosmos event, who, you get the sense, have businesses that are so far made up of a single pitch deck. You could see it in the gaggle of young, obviously elated entrepreneurial would-bes surrounding Tan, faces beaming, eager to make small talk about Christianity with one of Silicon Valley's leading investors. Thank you for saving San Francisco, a woman gushed, referring to Tan's recent involvement in San Francisco politics. He smiled and nodded. The founders encircled Tan ever closer, until he was completely surrounded and backed against the wall. They began at first with inquiries relating to Tan's talk, which spanned from the imminent arrival of an omniscient superintelligence to why we should deregulate its use. We're criminalizing something that's basically doing matrix multiplication, to the importance of attending church. Pleasantries now out of the way, the founders got down to business. They asked Tan if he would connect with them on LinkedIn. He did. They asked for selfies. He obliged. And then, one by one, his hopeful disciples pitched their startups. I'd love to tell you about my company, they said. And Tan, listening on with an air of pointed graciousness that was indeed Christ-like, continued his smiling and nodding, followed by variations on the reply, that's a good idea, do you have any customers? Or interesting concept, do you have customers? Invariably, the founders' faces fell, a newfound sheepishness creeping into their voices, as they replied no, or not yet, but soon. And Tan would say, reach out again when you have customers. And then he would move on to the next founder. This went on for at least half an hour, eventually becoming so monotonous that I wondered how any venture capitalist might have the patience, much less the optimism, for any real innovation, and I stepped away. In the cutthroat world of venture funding, founders are often taught to have a competitive advantage, or what the industry calls an edge, against their peers. When Thiel said in 2015 that many of Silicon Valley's successful entrepreneurs seem to have a mild form of Asperger's, overnight, kids started putting on an autism effect to seem smarter, one entrepreneur recalled. Like, you're not on the spectrum, you're just socially awkward, and you're trying to seem smart. These days, he argued, the same effect that engendered a class of people putting on neurodivergence is cultivating a new bent toward biblical altruism. This could be especially appealing to anyone seeking to stand out in a monoculture in which polycules and ketamine are mundane, but attending Sunday church service is subversive. You know, in cities like San Francisco and New York, being a Christian is a little bit of a vice, said a San Francisco consultant. In other words, the new religion is religion. One Y Combinator-backed entrepreneur told me with obvious distaste how Bookface, Y Combinator's internal social network, has lately filled up with pro-Christian messaging. It is, as Arjun Sethi, the co-CEO of the cryptocurrency exchange platform Kraken, said, only the latest prototype in a system crowded by identity politics. It's surface. It's a fad, he said. I think they are trying to replace ESG, the socially conscious investing principle that prioritizes environmental, social, and governance issues with Christianity. I guarantee you, one Christian entrepreneur told me, there are people that are leveraging Christianity to get closer to Peter Thiel. This is a reality not lost on Michelle Stevens, the founder of Acts 17 Collective, who is well aware that Valley Kingmakers might lure potential acolytes to Christian-adjacent events. In fact, it seemed that this is sort of the point of her organization. People in tech are fundamentally motivated by money, fame, and power, Stevens said. People with a lot of clout or business acumen and cred is how you get them in the door. These events are a collision of godliness and good old-fashioned hedonism. Amid caviar bumps and champagne, you might find yourself shoulder to shoulder with someone like Thiel, who is, as Stevens points out, a gay billionaire, and who at Acts 17 Collective's pilot event in May spoke at length about his relationship with Jesus Christ. These juxtapositions highlight that Christianity doesn't have to look a certain way, she said. The Jesus we know isn't the Jesus of religion. He is the Jesus of the people, for the people. Honest Christianity, despite what you may have learned or heard, is a radically inclusive faith. Silicon Valley's Christian awakening has no physical center, but one downtown San Francisco church, Epic, is gaining traction among the tech crowd. Its lead pastor is a lovely guy called Ben Pilgreen, who told me over the phone that post-pandemic, his congregation grew from 300 to more than 800. In a city that's renowned for being spectacularly godless, the surge of interest is surprising, he added, but not entirely unexpected. I think COVID did something to us, said Pilgreen. I'm still not sure about everything it did to us as a society or individuals, but it called people to think about what matters. It helps, too, that Epic Church hosts a series dedicated to people working in Silicon Valley's centers of innovation, CEOs and venture capitalists who regularly speak about how technology can be used in the glory of God. There's an ideological compatibility with a capitalist-friendly notion that each person has a calling and a vocation, and using your gifts to the max is a good thing, and it's what God would want, said Toby Kurth, a pastor who has headed Bible studies attended by Thiel. Or as Daniel Francis, the Catholic founder of the AI startup Able, put it, you have a duty as a founder to make really good products and get them into people's hands. You're making God real in people's lives when they experience that. Next photo, House of Worship. Ben Pilgreen is the founder and lead pastor of Epic, a non-denominational church that's gaining major traction among San Francisco's tech set. Implicit in Silicon Valley's religious fervor are its recent investments in serious people with serious visions, which accounts for the billions lately plowed into defense tech and artificial intelligence. Such fields raise big nagging questions about not only morality, but the nature of the human condition. Why is the Western view superior? Is it ethical to assert military dominance over other nations? If machines replicate human intelligence, and by extension consciousness, what will account for our species' exceptionalism? These are catechisms you can easily complete with a Protestant perspective. The United States is superior because it is a nation founded on the Bible, despite what the Constitution may assert about the separation of church and state. Our country has a moral obligation to assert global dominance in order to spread biblical values around the world. And humans are special because we are the pinnacle of God's creation. This religious framework fortifies other vexing existential concerns as well, including the lingering sense that the technology industry writ large maybe isn't such a great thing after all. Lately, a new, more thoughtful strain has entered my conversations with founders who express their off-the-record misgivings about the technology they themselves are building. These dialogues seem sincere in a way that is a frankly refreshing and novel reversal from the discussions I had with many of these same formerly fresh-faced entrepreneurs who pitched their startups with bald enthusiasm only a few years earlier. They say the tech industry can no longer rely, as it did in the mid-2010s, on the uncomplicated notion that it is making the world a better place. "Everyone hates tech now," a venture capitalist recently told me, looking vaguely self-conscious as he said it. For any principled technologist who may feel their industry is a wellspring of confusion and despair, it's comforting to believe that God created people to make cool products, and that making cool products actually is a good thing. Another idea gaining steam among some of the Silicon Valley faithful is the notion that tech is not an inherent evil. Rather, tech produced by bad thinking, and by extension secular thinking, is. This was the general theory floated by entrepreneur Reggie James in October at Hereticon, a Founders Fund-backed conference for creative dissidents. During its apocalypse-themed Miami gathering, Thiel spoke about the coming of the Antichrist. There, James introduced the idea of Secutech, or secular technology, designed from a secular perspective. His primary example is social media, which he told me over the phone engenders the postmodernist values of fighting over identity and representation. Everyone on social media is going through an identity crisis and some kind of disinformation campaign. That's not a bug. That's a feature of postmodern design. "There's an antidote to Secutech," says James, "and it's called spiritual technology, which is technology that, while not necessarily relying on a religious framework, is built with the understanding that values across religions are different from postmodernist secular tech values. But not every religious technologist is necessarily all in on Silicon Valley's burgeoning embrace of Christianity." Luke Burgess, a Catholic entrepreneur who recently hosted a dinner at the Vatican dealing with AI, said there's a danger in trying to map Christianity onto everything that Silicon Valley is doing. This is the goal, Burgess noted, of the 1626 novel The New Atlantis, which has piqued the interest of some Silicon Valley circles. The novel envisions a secretive quasi-Christian society that, through technological experiments, controls the weather, overcomes aging, and builds heaven on earth. These godlike efforts are at work in industries like defense tech, which Burgess warned is such brilliant branding because it's not always used that way. But, he added, there's also artificial superintelligence, which is the idea that machines will soon compete with and eventually supersede human intelligence. In Silicon Valley, said Burgess, there's a strong strain in which they're trying to create something that would take the place of a god. Few people have fueled that anxiety on the same order as Sam Altman, the OpenAI co-founder, who believes that AI will usher in massive prosperity, as he wrote in one essay, and make us capable of doing things that would have seemed like magic to our grandparents. From the stage at Code and Cosmos, Tan tells us how only yesterday he spent 5 hours talking with Altman, whose treatise, he said with shining eyes, is almost a work of faith itself, of AGI and ASI, potentially in thousands of days. Tan continues, Sam thinks we will actually unlock physics and the secrets of science and technology to a point where we will have abundance on tap. Some of what Tan had been getting at on stage reminded me of those Silicon Valley technologists that Burgess warned me about, the ones who are so eager to manufacture their own god. And admittedly, at one point in the reporting of this story, I started down a highly cynical, conspiratorial line of thought that some people in Silicon Valley, like Tan, were cloaking their ambitions to build a god under the guise of traditional religion, like a 21st century version of Joseph Smith, with a direct line to a godlike intelligence that performs technological miracles, I posited to Eliezer Yudkowsky, the co-founder of the Thiel-backed Machine Intelligence Research Institute, who has warned that the unchecked development of superintelligent machines will result in humanity's certain extinction. Yudkowsky was quick to throw cold water on that idea, arguing that religious thinking has little utility in uncovering the motivations and stakes of AI. At the core of everything, there's a factual question. How much power does AI end up with in the limit? Can its makers control it? He told me. You can't settle it by religious thinking. You can't settle it by accusing other people of religious thinking. If someone could actually build a god for $20 billion and have it follow their orders, they wouldn't need to be religious to want to do that. When I took Tan aside to ask why he thought a Christian perspective was relevant to anyone working on artificial intelligence, he told me that it was imperative for people working in tech to realize that they're building for something beyond themselves, their families and communities, he said. Technology is so powerful right now that you need to have this sort of touch grass moment. People are so ready to make AGI their god, Tan added. What we're trying to do with events like this is give them an alternative. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Toni Collette, the actor and Mickey 17 star on Travel Regrets, Acupuncture, and Jumping into the Ocean. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Chastity, pointless. Who came up with that? On what occasion do you lie to my dentist about the regularity of my flossing? What is your idea of perfect happiness, floating on my back in the ocean? What is your greatest extravagance? Flights to Italy. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? This is the best thing I've ever eaten, and hilarious, and Arlo, get off your phone. What is your favorite journey? Summer days spent jumping off a boat into the sea, or winter days on a train, both preferably in Italy, but I'll pretty much jump into any clean body of water. Which living person do you most admire? Anyone brave enough to truly be themselves? What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I'm terribly impatient. What is your greatest regret? Saying no to being the face of Qantas when I was 22, I'd only made 2 films and wanted to be taken seriously as an actor. I live to travel. What an idiot. Shall we regroup? What is your greatest fear? Losing my mind. Which historical figure do you most identify with? I'm not religious, but I think Jesus was the coolest. What is the trait you most deplore in others? People-pleasing. Which living person do you most despise? Ignorant presidents, plural. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Besides my children who own my heart, I am lucky to have loved and been loved. Real love is everything and very rare. When and where were you happiest? Right now, summer, dusk. On my couch, watching Australian Open tennis with my kids and dog, doors wide open to a beautiful body of water, the first star of the night just appeared in the sky. Life is magical. What is your current state of mind? Post-acupuncture stoned. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Nah, it's taken a while, but I accept it all. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Feeling truly alone. Because we are actually and ultimately all very much connected, whether we acknowledge it or not. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Maybe we'd add a cat, a pig, some chickens. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Maud from Hal Ashby's film, Harold and Maud. She's authentic, wild, and not afraid of life or death. Who are your heroes in real life? People who are naturally inclined to help others. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? An effective peacemaker. What is your most treasured possession? Notes from my kids. What is it that you most dislike? Smoking, moronic and selfish. Don't contaminate everyone else's air while you slowly commit suicide. Where would you like to live? Totally immersed in nature. What is your favorite occupation? My own. I have loved it for 35 years and counting. What is your most marked characteristic? For better or worse, I am somewhat impulsive. Who are your favorite writers? Rumi, Hafez, Elizabeth Strout, James Baldwin, Anton Chekhov, Marcus Aurelius, Tim Winton, Donna Tartt, Miriam Toews, Elizabeth Gilbert, too many. What are your favorite names? Sage and Arlo. What is your motto? Keep your heart open. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Toni Collette. the family business. Together, Oren and Tal Alexander formed one of America's premier real estate teams with billions of dollars in sales. Alon, Oren's twin, helped run their father's private security firm. Now, they await criminal trial in a Brooklyn jail, facing multiple accusations of rape and assault from women across the country. Willem Marks reports on the fall of the Alexander brothers. Opening photo, Oren and Alon Alexander, accused of rape by multiple women and charged with federal and state crimes, attend their bond hearing on December 13th in Miami. Jane left her two sisters and a friend napping at their hotel, resting up for the New Year's Eve festivities. It was late afternoon by the time the Uber dropped her alone at the Miami Beach apartment building, with its lobby of marble and dark wood and an elegant pool backing out onto the sand. Alon, the tall, handsome, successful man she'd been excited to see a third time, had texted her a picture of a barbecue in full swing. He came down to meet her, greeting her with a hug, and up they went. The elevator opened into an airy apartment with floor-to-ceiling windows, where two other men stood beside a kitchen island. One of them, Oren, was Alon's identical twin. Alon introduced her to the other, Ohad, as their cousin. But Jane was immediately confused. There was no sign of any other guest, no barbecue apparent at all. Nonetheless, the group made small talk for several minutes before Alon beckoned her to follow him to another room. She had matched with him over the summer on Bumble while she was living in New York. They had a mutual acquaintance from her college days in Orlando. They'd first met for drinks at his sprawling Soho loft, and they had sex, consensually, and again just after a Carrie Underwood concert. They'd reconnected after realizing they were both in Miami Beach for the holiday. Jane hoped the invitation that afternoon indicated Alon might consider her more than just a casual hookup. But as she followed him through the doorway to a bedroom, shooing away a maid, Jane suddenly understood she was not being given a tour of the apartment. And then Ohad and Oren walked in, single file. Oren closed and locked the door. Ohad clambered onto the bed, pulled Jane back by the shoulders, then pinned her upper arms beneath his knees. It was like a ritual thing, she recalls now. Everyone knew what to do. Terrified, her heart rate spiked and tears began to pour as Oren, speaking nonchalantly to Alon about who's going to go first, despite Jane's clear distress, wrestled off her jean shorts and bikini bottom, took off his own pants, and rolled on a condom. "Please don't," she cried out as he painfully penetrated her, turning toward Alon, who had taken a seat next to the bed and watched in silence. "They were just completely ignoring me," she recalls. "I was there, but I wasn't there." She thought feigning enjoyment might bring the nightmare to an end faster, but her pretense seemed to irritate Oren, muttering, "F this." He ripped off the prophylactic and stormed out. Jane began to cry hysterically. Alon then stood, put on his own condom, and began to rape her too, as she continued to sob. After he finished, he fell back onto the chair and casually picked up his phone. Without looking up, he addressed her for the first time since they had entered the room. "We're not leaving here until you F my cousin," he said, referring to Ohad. "Please no, please no, please no," Jane remembers begging him. "Well," he relented, "you have to at least give him head." She continued to refuse, whimpering, until Alon gave up and ordered her into a shower. As she left the apartment, Alon dashed up with a towel around his waist and kissed her on the cheek with a warning, "Don't tell anybody about this." She took an Uber back to the hotel, where she slumped in another shower, barely able to breathe, and told her sisters everything. Now, 8 years later, Jane's allegations, recounted in more starched legalese, form part of an indictment against Alon and Oren Alexander, issued on December 11th by Florida's Miami-Dade state attorney. The same day, the U.S. Attorney for New York's Southern District charged the twins and an older brother, Tal, with three counts of sex trafficking offenses, including a conspiracy involving all three from at least 2010 through at least 2021. Prosecutors say they have interviewed at least 60 women and have accused each of the three brothers of violent, forcible rape of at least 10 women, each leaving their victims frightened that the alleged assailants might hurt or even kill them, or hunt them down afterward if they divulge their experiences. Right after those criminal charges landed, Jane Doe became one of what, at the time of publication, are 17 women to have filed civil lawsuits against Oren, Alon, and Tal, alleging sexual assault or rape. All of those suits remain open, except for one that included all three brothers, which a New York judge has dismissed due to a missed filing deadline. The accuser plans to appeal. Oren, Alon, and Tal have maintained their innocence, as has Ohad Fisherman, whose attorney Jeffrey Sloman told Vanity Fair that Fisherman denies the allegations in the state charges, as well as Jane Doe's civil case, noting that Fisherman is not a relative of the Alexander brothers. Through his attorney, Howard Shrebnick, Alon said, "The only sexual encounters I have had in my lifetime have been consensual and legal." Through Jennifer Wilson, his counsel, Oren denied ever raping anyone, adding, "These character-smearing attacks, many of which result from plaintiff's lawyers' recruiting efforts and individuals seeking to personally profit at my expense, will not hold up in court." Deanna Paul, an attorney for Tal, told Vanity Fair her client had never raped or sexually assaulted anyone, and that no number of false allegations or salacious media coverage changed that reality. All four men have pleaded not guilty to all charges. Denied bail in their federal criminal case, the three Alexander brothers sit in a Brooklyn jail, awaiting trial currently scheduled for January 2026. It's a far fast fall from the peak of their recent status as a high-powered real estate family. Tal and Oren had become two of America's leading brokers amid a sea of reality TV-powered super sales. They helped sell a $238 million Central Park apartment to hedge fund titan Ken Griffin, and became go-to agents for bold-faced names, including Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, and Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. Alon, a graduate of New York Law School, helped expand the family's private security business from Miami to New York and across the country. In 2022, the New York Times profiled Tal and Oren for a piece titled "How Two Luxury Real Estate Agents Spend Their Sundays." A month later, the Wall Street Journal splashed an exclusive on all three brothers selling a shared property in a story titled "Real Estate Power Brokers List Miami Beach Home for $31.5 million. The following spring, Vogue featured Oren's wedding to a Brazilian model, sharing details of his Aspen proposal and their 350-person engagement party during Miami's Art Basel week. But beneath the trappings of luxury was a much darker story. Over the course of several months, Vanity Fair spoke to dozens of sources, including many of the accusers, as well as friends and business associates, to paint a picture of staggering contrast. The brothers Alexander, shining testaments to American wealth, winning public recognition at charity galas. The brothers Alexander, who have allegedly perpetrated years of sexual violence, leaving deep emotional trauma and outright terror in their wake. Throughout their time at Dr. Michael M. Krupp Senior High School in North Miami, the Alexander twins and their tennis star brother, Tal, had reputations for arrogance and hard partying, and ran with a small clique of other highly privileged boys. At luxurious homes and gated communities, according to a number of high school contemporaries, the brothers and their friends hosted large gatherings with minimal parental supervision, where young people used kitchen counters to crush and snort benzos downing booze by the handle. Occasionally, some of the boys would retire to dimly lit, beautifully appointed bedrooms for sexual encounters that were rarely private, say multiple sources, frequently recorded on camera, and not always consensual, with girls who were not always conscious. One woman remembers a drunken teenage makeout session with Elon at the brother's home in upscale Bal Harbour. Oren had stopped at the doorway and asked a question in Hebrew. Elon translated it for her. He wanted to go get the video camera, and I said no, she recalls him explaining. Other girls, according to multiple sources, did not receive the same reprieve. The Alexanders and their friends would arrive at parties in small convoys of luxury cars, say the contemporaries, BMW X5s and Cadillac Escalades, with DVD screens on seat backs playing porn, including recordings of their own exploits. When the twins were sophomores, they began hanging out with a group of freshman girls every other weekend. One of those girls, who has since pursued a medical career and who hasn't spoken about her experiences until now, hooked up with Elon while her friend fooled around with Aaron. Occasionally, the Alexanders' parents would be home and react angrily to the goings-on, the woman says. But the twins had bedrooms on the ground floor of the 6,000-square-foot house, far from where their parents slept, and spent unsupervised time at a nearby unfurnished property that their father, Shlomo, known as Shlomi, was developing. The Alexander parents did not respond to a list of detailed questions sent to them by Vanity Fair. At some point during this period, Elon began to invite other teenage boys into the room when they had sex, the woman says, over her stated objections. But during a months-long period in 2002, she began losing control of her faculties and memory in the twins' company. She now suspects her drinks were being spiked. It started off just being kind of just normal, she recalls, and it ended up escalating to like you no longer essentially would remember the night, or you would remember essentially just little bits and pieces of the night. Ask if boys other than Elon, including Aaron and Tal, may have had sex with her while she was unconscious, had raped her, her response was immediate. Probably, 100%. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.